Speaking, the title of his presentation is The Effect of Community Water Fluoridation on Inequalities in Oral Health. Dr. Michael McGrady is here from England, across the pond. Michael is currently an honorary lecturer and NHS trainee in dental public health at the University of Manchester, England. He has recently completed a PhD in community dentistry, dental public health under Professor Ian Pritty on his NIHR UK Clinician Scientist Award, delivering a series of research projects concerning the assessment of caries and fluorosis and the impact of water fluoridation. After graduating from the University of Liverpool in 1995, Michael spent 5 years in a general dental practice before joining a contract research organization while obtaining a postgraduate diploma in pharmaceutical clinical research. His role included acting as an investigator and a clinical assessor for oral care studies, training of clinical assessors in ICH, GCP, and clinical indices, the development of training, calibration programs, and communication of developments in regulatory and ethical affairs.
Good morning. Thank you very much for the opportunity to present to you today on some of the findings from our work from a UK context. Just to say we have no relationships to disclose, although I do have a kindergarten-acquired head cold, courtesy of my daughter. So please forgive me if my voice does break a little as we go through. So just to give a little bit of background and set the scene, we'll talk a little bit about the outline of the project in context to work I was doing for my doctorate thesis. We'll talk a little bit about the methodology, results and discussion, and some conclusions. So the outline of my project, it came about because of a number of issues that were raised by systematic reviews on community water fluoridation within the UK, which stated that whilst there was evidence to suggest that water fluoridation would reduce caries, the evidence base on which those conclusions were based needed to be improved. So we were looking at means of addressing study design to look at social inequalities, some confounding factors, to try and reduce bias and subjectivity, all of that within the context of community water fluoridation, in particular looking at dental caries and dental fluorosis. Now the areas under observation and the data we're going to report this morning were two urban populations in northern England. One was Newcastle, which is in northeast England, which has a water fluoride content of 1 part per million, and that's both natural fluoride and adjusted. And that's been in place since 1968. And we're going to look at comparing that to Manchester in the northwest of England, which is non-fluoridated. Now, both those urban populations presented quite a wide and diverse spectrum of levels of deprivation. So what we were looking at was approximately 2,000 pupils over about 25 schools in both those urban populations. And we were looking at the prevalence and severity of caries and fluorosis, comparing the fluoridated population with the non-fluoridated. And from that, we'd look to see if there were any effects of water fluoridation on inequalities in oral health. So looking at the methodology and how we recruited the subjects to the study, we selected schools to try and aim a balance between the two urban areas on demographics and deprivation. And we approached schools based on something called the percentage free school meal entitlement, which is a surrogate measure for deprivation. And it allowed us to balance between the two cities on deprivation, but also provide us with a range of schools that were either deprived or less deprived. From the data from subjects, using zip code or postcode data, as we call it in the UK, we were then able to ascribe a more individual level of deprivation using something called the Index of Multiple Deprivation. Now, this index is a composite index, which is derived and weighted for a number of indicators, which include income, employment, health and disability, education, skills and training, barriers to housing, living environment, and crime. For caries assessment, we used ICDAS, the International Caries Detection and Assessment System. And we did that because we knew we could have validation with the histological stage of the disease. We were able to record early stages of the disease process. And what we wanted to do is provide some level of flexibility on how we reported severity, because we were going to report DMFT, but we could use the ICDAS score for the D component, and we could present at different threshold levels, like white spot lesion, ICDAS code 2 and above, and a threshold of caries into dentine, ICDAS code 4 and above. For a fluorosis assessment, we use the Thilstrup and Verger score for TF index. Again, an index with the clinical score linked to the histology of the condition on a 10-point scale. And we were actually taking standardized photographs so we could do remote scoring to minimize bias with those. So in this study in Newcastle and Manchester, we had an adolescent population aged 11 to 13 of lifetime residents, both males and females. We were able to have the free school percentage free school meal entitlement to target schools, and from that the index of multiple deprivation for a subject level measure of deprivation. We have the clinical caries exam using ICDAS, and the clinical fluorosis scores by remote scoring of the digital photographs using the TF index. So looking at the results for the demographics, in total we had 1,783 subjects that completed the study, 910 in the fluoridated population in Newcastle, and 873 in the non-fluoridated population in Manchester. Our mean age exam in Newcastle was 12.56, and in Manchester, 12.32. The gender, in Newcastle we had 54% males, 46% females, and in Manchester we had 57% males and 43% females. So a reasonable balance between the two study sites. Looking at deprivation, again we managed to attain balance between the cities. The mean IMD score for Newcastle was 35.2, and in Manchester the mean IMD score was 37.4. Looking at caries with a threshold white spot lesion, the overall prevalence in the fluoridated population in Newcastle was 75%. In Manchester, it was 85%. Looking at the mean DMFT, decayed, missing, and filled teeth, in Newcastle that mean was 2.94. In Manchester, it was 4.48. And regression analysis revealed an odds ratio of 2.11 for developing caries in Manchester, the non-fluoridated population, compared to Newcastle, the fluoridated population. When we look at the data for caries into dentine, the prevalence in Newcastle was 33%, in Manchester 46%. The mean DMFT, Newcastle 0.65, in Manchester 1.07. This time the odds ratio from regression analysis was 1.84 for developing caries in non-fluoridated Manchester compared to Newcastle. Now this chart represents the caries and deprivation if we look at the white spot lesion across the quintiles of deprivation. So on the y-axis we have the mean score for DMFT, and across the x-axis the quintiles of deprivation, 1 being the least deprived, 5 being the most deprived. What this illustrates, again, is the relationship between caries and deprivation. Looking at the bars, the blue bar with blue trend line is the fluoridated population in Newcastle. The green bar and green trend line is the non-fluoridated population in Manchester. And we can see that there is a difference between the two localities, with lower levels of caries across the quintiles of deprivation for the fluoridated population. So the mean DMFT in the least deprived quintile in fluoridated Newcastle was 1.89, in Manchester that was 2.54. And the most deprived quintile in Newcastle is 3.8, in Manchester is 5.76. Now when we look at the caries into dentine, same looking across the quintiles of deprivation, we can see there's a greater gap between the two localities. Again, the blue bars representing the fluoridated population in Newcastle, the green bars the non-fluoridated population in Manchester. So looking at caries and deprivation, the mean DMFT of the least deprived quintile was 0.38, and Manchester was 0.45. And the mean DMFT in the most deprived quintile in Newcastle was 0.99, in Manchester it was 1.52. Now, this chart represents the proportion of caries-free, and I do use that term carefully when I say caries-free, at a white spot lesion level. And again, across the quintiles of deprivation, you can see as they become more deprived, the fewer subjects there are who are caries-free. In this instance, the red line represents the fluoridated population in Newcastle. The green line represents the non-fluoridated population in Manchester. So you can see that there are clear differences, again, between the two populations. So looking at white spot lesions, the proportion caries-free in the least deprived quintile in Newcastle was 39%, in Manchester was 31%. For the most deprived quintile in Newcastle, it was 16%. In Manchester, it was 9%. So we have significant differences between the two localities, but no apparent reduction in the social gradient. When we compare that to the proportion of caries-free subjects looking at caries into dentine, again, Newcastle in red, fluoridated population, Manchester in green, the non-fluoridated population. Once again, we can see the trend of fewer subjects who are caries-free as we go up the quintiles of deprivation. But we can see that there is a difference between the two localities in terms of the social gradient. The proportion of caries-free in the least deprived quintile in Newcastle, 78%, Manchester, 72%. The proportion of caries-free in the most deprived quintile in Newcastle was 56%, in Manchester it was 39%. So this time you have significant differences between the areas and a reduction in the social gradient. So looking at fluorosis, the prevalence and severity, the prevalence in Newcastle, the fluoridated population, was 55%. And of those, 48% had a TF score of 1 or 2, and 7% had a TF score of 3 or higher, representing a more aesthetically significant type of fluorosis. In Manchester, that was 27%, and 26% having TF 1 or 2, and only 1.2% having a TF of 3 or higher. And regression analysis here revealed an odds ratio of developing fluorosis of 3.39 in Newcastle, a fluoridated population, compared to Manchester. So the conclusions we can draw, that there are significant differences in the caries levels between the fluoridated and non-fluoridated populations across the quintiles of deprivation, whether we're looking at decayed, missing and filled teeth or the proportion caries-free. And community water fluoridation contributes to reduction in social class gradient between deprivation and caries, particularly when you're looking at caries just thresholded at a level of caries into dentine. But this is associated with an increased risk of fluorosis. So I guess what we're saying here is, yeah, water fluoridation is contributing, but there are other means and forms of preventing dental caries. Terms and conditions apply. And if development of any white spots on your teeth, please consult your physician. Just a few acknowledgements for this work. This work was funded by NIHR UK Clinician Scientist Award for Professor Ian Pretty. Acknowledged the work of our collaborators in the University of Newcastle and the National Health Service Newcastle Primary Care Trust, and of course the pupils and staff of the schools who participated. Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Dr. McGrady. Any questions? Howard?
From a fellow Mancunian, I want to thank you for your wonderful presentation.
Thank you, Howard.
When the results were displayed, I wiped my brow with the fact that they were the
you're not the only person who wiped their brow with hair. I didn't want to come across as the person who drove the nail into the coffin for community water fluoridation in the UK. I'm not too sure if the audience are aware that the community water fluoridation is looked upon slightly differently in the UK as it is over here in the United States. And there are quite a lot of people who are very much against expanding our water fluoridation schemes.
That's also the case here. and this is a plug for the session at 2:30 this afternoon. So I have a few questions.
Yeah.
And if I may, I'll just ask you one at a time.
So typically with an 11 to 12 year old age group, the second molars, permanent molars, have not erupted yet, and so most of the caries I would expect was on first molars, first permanent molars, rather than other teeth. Could you do you have data on which specific teeth were affected
by caries?
It's true to say that the vast majority of caries was located on the first molars. Yes, they were still very much in a mixed dentition. It was only the permanent teeth we looked at. And I know that one of the criticisms with water fluoridation is it delays eruption, etc. Are we looking at difference in caries levels because of different time periods of exposure in the oral environment? What I could say about that, when we looked at the data, there were no differences between the teeth present for examination between the two populations, with the exception of the lower left second premolar for some reason. The two populations are actually quite evenly balanced.
Thank you. So as a follow-up question, we're doing a little dance here. Staying with caries now, you talked about bias and trying to bend over backwards to eliminate bias. Were there any efforts to reduce bias in caries assessments?
Yeah, as I stated at the beginning of the presentation, it's part of a much larger project that was looking at addressing bias and subjectivity. The clinical ICLS exams were only one component. We were actually taking intraoral photographs using a proprietary intraoral camera and then performing remote scoring on that data too. When we looked at comparison between the two scoring systems, certainly if you take the high-risk caries surface, the occlusal surface of the first molars, there was actually a kappa of 0.83 between the photographic examinations and the remote scoring. And I was the only examiner on the study for caries and fluorosis.
In both communities,
yes. So I was the sole examiner. The reason why I've not reported the data from the intraoral photographs is partly for time constraints, and also there are some issues of the fact that the intraoral camera didn't have polarizing filters, so there was some specular reflection on the teeth, which has meant there could have been some issues with scoring some of the less severe presentations of caries, and also trying to visualize the interproximal surfaces as well. So there was some data loss there from the intraoral photographs. But when we compared the two, the trends between the two populations, fluoridated and non-fluoridated, were largely the same.
If I may, just the last question. With regard to fluorosis, use the TF index, so that goes up to 9. What was the maximum TF scores that you found in both communities? What was the prevalence of that? And would that be equivalent to the Dean's index of moderate or severe fluorosis? Thank you.
Okay. If I recall correctly, out of the 1783 subjects who completed the study, there were only 68 subjects who had a TF score of 3 or higher across the entire study. Of those, 65 were resident in the fluoridated population in Newcastle. The remaining 3 were in the Manchester or non-fluoridated, and we can only assume that they were lifetime residents. It was probably through ingestion of fluoridated dentifrice. In fact, I mean, there's certainly enough evidence to suggest that the more severe presentations were as a result of sort of crossing that threshold barrier between what you might expect from water fluoridation at one part per million and then adding in fluoride from other sources, such as dentifrice. The most severe presentation was a TF5, so you had some early loss of the enamel surface around the incisal edge, and that was actually a subject in the non-fluoridated population of Manchester, again, more than likely due to ingestion of dentifrice.
Are fluoride supplements prescribed in Manchester?
Interestingly enough, we have something in the UK called Delivering Better Oral Health, a preventive toolkit for all dental practitioners within the NHS to use. And in there, we talk about the advocation of supplements. To be perfectly honest, in the entire population of the study we looked at, there were only 3 subjects who had actually been prescribed supplements. So that they're actually vanishingly rare, even within a non-fluoridated, high caries population such as Manchester.
My question is about dental sealants. Are dental sealants used in the UK, and is there a social gradient on how they're delivered?
Yeah, there are dental sealants in the UK. They are advocated. Within this particular survey, we class those surfaces as being sound. In terms of social gradient, it's difficult to tell. That's not data we looked at.
I was wondering how much of the lack of any difference among the most favored bits was because they in both communities, they had some sealants.
I would have to check the data again, but anecdotally, I would say that the proportion of subjects who'd had their first molars sealed was actually quite low. That's not to say that they hadn't been sealed at some point and they'd lost the sealants. But I'm afraid it's data that we haven't really looked at closely. Sorry, 2 questions earlier.
Thank you for a wonderful presentation. The urban areas in the UK have become increasingly diverse racially and ethnically in the past couple of decades. And I was wondering what the racial ethnic distributions were between these two cities, if they were comparable, and if they were, then to what extent were there any within city variations in areas of racism?
I mean, certainly we have to sort of accept the limitations of the study, and in the context it was set to cross-sectional, it's a selected population. Newcastle is a much smaller city than Manchester, and whilst there are pockets of ethnicity, they're much lower than what you'd find in Manchester. So we select the population in Newcastle and then try to match that population in Manchester as best we could through data obtained through the schools. We didn't really look at how much of an effect ethnicity had on the outcome. To be perfectly honest, there were fewer than 5% of the study subjects who would fall into ethnic minorities.
Question about the informed consent process. I wonder if you could just describe...
A nightmare, as I would describe it. the informed consent was an interesting one. We bear in mind it's an observational study. In the UK, we have a national programme, the Dental Epidemiology Programme, which historically has gone on sort of negative consent, i.e. you pitch up at the schools, you turn up, you do the examinations. That all changed a number of years ago where they were looking for parental consent for these subjects. Our ethics committee forced us down the route of positive consent from parents prior to positive consent from the children, with disastrous results. We petitioned the ethics committee to say, look, we're looking at an observational survey here. We have adolescents who are clearly competent to consent to this process. So we moved to a system of parental opt-out. So we would post information sheets for the parents and a picture-based, less text version for the children to the parents for them to read through, to get an understanding, contacts to get in touch with the city team if they wanted more information, and an option to say, look, I don't want my child to take part. 2 weeks before we arrived at each individual school, we sent out another pack, say, just to remind you, another opportunity to opt out if you don't want your child to take part. When we arrived at the schools, we then obtained fully informed written consent from the subjects. Now, we were able to do that partly because we demonstrated the resounding failure of the positive consent route, but also the reassurances to the IRB, we would report back with our findings of the number of subjects who slipped through the net or things of that nature, and thankfully none did. And we found it was quite a good system to use, provided you stick within the caveat of this particular age group who are competent to consent for this procedure or this observational study, and not sort of go say we can do this for all studies. It was within the context of this particular survey. Again, it's one of the limitations. We're looking at cross-sectional survey, the timing of fluorosis risk. It would have been based upon data which would have been too prone to recall bias. So we made an assumption that all of the population would receive fluoridate dentifrice at a minimum of 1,000 ppm. Most adult toothpaste in the UK has 1,500 ppm fluoride. So that's not taking into account any other means of fluoride exposure, such as topical fluoride. So our assumptions were actually perhaps underestimating the effect of the community water fluoridation because we weren't taking into account all the additional means of fluoride through topical varnishes, etc., that the non-fluoridated population would be exposed to. So it was an assumption.
Are there any more? Thank you, Michael.